from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, Betty Reed Suskin is at 93 the oldest national park ranger in the United States. She came to the Bay Area in 1927 as a six-year-old girl and now works at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park in Richmond. Her tours reflect her perspective as an African-American woman in the Bay Area during World War II.
This park tells so many stories.
We'll talk to Betty Reed Suskin and hear her stories. It's part of Forum's first-person series profiling the leaders, innovators, and others who make our region unique. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. As part of our ongoing first-person series profiling the leaders, innovators, and others who make our region unique, we welcome Betty Reed Suskin to this Forum Hour. At 93, she's the oldest national park ranger in the United States, and she came to the Bay Area in 1927 as a six-year-old girl and now works at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park in Richmond, where she has been since 2003 and where she provides historical depth, both personal and cultural, to the tour she leads as an African-American woman. Her great-grandmother was a slave, and her grandmother and great-grandmother each lived to be over 100 years, and we welcome her to this Forum Hour. So good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
I should mention that Betty and I were talking a little bit about age before we went on the air, and I was saying, and I'm sorry if don't shoot the messenger on this, but most people start to go into decline, particularly after the age of 85. I mean, the numbers are against you. Here you are starting as a park ranger at the age of 85.
That's right.
How did that come to pass?
Well, I was working up in the state of California, actually, as a field representative for a member of the California State Assembly at the time, which put me in a one-person satellite office in Richmond, and at the time when the park was being formed. And as such, because a part of the Ford building was actually built on state-owned land between the years of 1929 and 1931, and because of that, there was a seat at the planning table for the state of California, and I was in that seat so that I became a part of the planning.
You helped develop the plans for the park. I mean, ahead of – this was what, back with 2001, roughly?
Not officially, rather casually at first.
Uh-huh. And you wanted to see it honoring the women of World War II.
I wanted to see it honoring the home front. Actually,
the women workers. Yeah.
Part of that was the story of Rosie the Riveter, the women workers, but that story is very, very complex. It has many, many moving parts.
Well, it's a story of white women mainly, isn't it? Really,
Rosie the Riveter is largely a story of white women, because of course black women have been working outside their homes in slavery, and I didn't consider myself a Rosie, nor did I connect with that story at all, but I did connect with the home front story, because that was probably the greatest mobilization of workers since the building of the pyramids or the Great Wall of China. That was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's A Great Arsenal of Democracy. And that story is what fascinated me.
Well, the jobs for you were, as an African-American woman, were quite limited. You came here from New Orleans to East Oakland and I believe worked first for the Boilermakers Union?
I actually came into the home front story working as a clerk in a Jim Crow segregated union hall or in Boilermakers, Auxiliary 38, 36, because the unions were not yet racially integrated and wouldn't be for another decade. So that I worked in an all-black union.
And that was just the way it was. It was accepted because
that's who we were in 1942.
And the other thing about it is that you came here – well, New Orleans, of course, is, as we say, you know, very distinctive in terms of the South.
It absolutely.
Has its cosmopolitan and all that. But came here really from the South, although I think you were born in Detroit. But here you come from the South, and suddenly things are radically different. I mean, as they were for so many of that great black migration that Isabel Wilkerson has written about.
I don't think that at 6 years old I was able to connect with the social system as existed either in New Orleans or in California. And that's what I grew into. My education was all acquired here in Oakland, California.
So there wasn't the kind of contrast even at six through your six-year-old's eyes that you see when you see blacks and whites together, for example?
I hadn't yet entered school. Uh-huh. And the world, as far as I was concerned, was an all-Creole world. Because up until I was 6 years old, the only people I saw were people who looked like me.
Well, the possibilities as you grew up in East Oakland, and even in East Oakland or in the East Bay, what is today the East Bay, as it's changed enormously, possibilities were really limited. You could work in a Jim Crow boilerplate union, boilermaker union place, or you could work in agriculture. You could work as a domestic. That was
about it. I was a child of the service workers generation.
Yes,
our fathers and our uncles were the red caps and the Pullman porters and the chefs and the janitors, and our mothers were 50 cents an hour domestic servants working, taking care of white people's children in white people's homes. That when I graduated from high school. The usual route for entrance into the workplace for an African-American young woman would have been limited to two. We could have entered from working on agriculture, or we could have worked as domestic servants. That is what my possibilities were. So working even in a Jim Crow segregated union hall in 1942 was the equivalent of today's young woman of color being the first to enter college. That was the equivalence. That's who we were in 1942.
No resentment, bitterness about this when you look back?
I'm not certain that I ever spent much time until the 60s.
When the whole black liberation movement started?
No, I guess that would have been in the 1950s when we built a home in Walnut Creek for the first time and had that experience of being the first family of color in the Diablo Valley, or the second one. I think the first was Jack and Eleanor Watkins and their twins. And moving into a completely hostile area.
You were threatened, in fact, weren't you?
Yes, yes.
Because you wanted to build a home there.
Because we did build a home
there.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. Yeah.
But that same community, which threatened our lives in 1953, which would have been when we built our home, sent me to represent them as a McGovern delegate in 1972 to Miami Beach. That's how fast social change was occurring in the Bay Area.
Yeah, you
That's what we forget.
Talk about this on your tours, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Fast the change.
Because I've seen more change than I think any other 10 people over my lifetime.
And you're talking about the black migration here. I mean, what,
yeah.
Some 70,000 workers went to the shipyards World War II?
Well, Henry Kaiser brought in a workforce of 98,000 people, mostly black and white Southerners, out of the five Southern states of Mississippi, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, and Louisiana. And they would have been black and white Southerners who wouldn't be sharing drinking fountains for another 20 years back in their places of origin. And he brought into a city with a population of 23,000, a workforce of 98,000. By the end of the war, the population of Richmond had risen to 130,000. It's only 107,000 now. If you can imagine the kind of chaos without any kind of infrastructures to support them, without schools or housing or anything, that they had to negotiate every single day to get through it in order to complete those ships. And together, those sharecroppers behind a man with an eighth grade education who had never built a ship, by the end of the war had completed 747 ships in 3 years and 8 months, even under that broken social system.
Betty Reed Soskin with us, park ranger with the National Park Service, Rosie the Riveter, World War II Homefront National Historical Park in Richmond, California. The narratives that you have about World War II, about the lessons, about the difficulties that African Americans had, and there are things certainly to have to face, and any student who faces this history really learns about the onerous side of it and the formidable challenges that it presents. But you always seem to come out optimistic about how the country came together.
Not always.
No?
No. I think that is that age has presented with it a situation in which I think I'm more aware in my 90s of being an evolving person in an evolving nation than I could have been at 75. That's what I'm impressed with now, is that I have seen so much change. I'm aware that every generation has to recreate democracy in its time.
In fact, you went to the inauguration with a picture of your grandmother
in my breast pocket.
Yes,
and I'm
inauguration
I'm,
of Obama.
Yeah, but I'm in on January 20th of 2009. I'm a seated guest of George Miller on the Capitol Mall.
East Bay Congressman. Yes,
yes, with a picture of my great grandmother, who was born in 1846 into slavery, and was enslaved until she was 19. Freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. And I'm sitting there with a picture in my pocket watching the inauguration of the first African-American president in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial, whose life was contemporary with the life of my great-grandmother. That's how fast the time goes. And that's an amazing thing, because my grandmother lived to be 102, which means that when she died, as I was born in 1921, I was a grown woman, married with children, 27 years old when my slave ancestor died.
You got this matrilinear centenarian line of yours. I mean,
absolutely.
You're 93, grandmother 100.
My mother was 101. My mother was raised by my great-grandmother. Mother was born in 1894 and died in 1995 at 101. And the three of us were adults at the same time.
Do you have any advice to people who want to live to 100 at this stage?
I don't know. I think they ought to keep their resumes polished.
Betty Reed, I told you were an optimist. Larry Susskind is the park ranger, the oldest park ranger in the United States, with the Rosie the River World War II Homefront National Historical Park, which is located in Richmond and home to the largest concentration of intact World War II historic sites in the country.
Right.
That's quite distinguished and quite something that maybe a lot of people don't know.
Well, though there were many boom towns throughout the nation, because the boom towns grew up around all of the defense plants, only in Richmond were there enough still standing structures through which to interpret that history than any other place in the country.
Well, you've interpreted a lot of history, particularly about African Americans in World War II and the workplace.
Yes.
But also, as things have changed, you've become much more mindful of, you use the phrase people of color, of the role that Asian workers, Asian American workers played, and other people of color.
Absolutely.
Latino.
The Becerro movement, because people don't understand that in 1942, California was largely an agricultural state. And it was being farmed by Japanese and Japanese Americans, Northern California was. And that when those 120,000 Japanese, when Japanese Americans were interned, 70,000 of them were American citizens, they had to be replaced by the Becerro movement, which brought Mexicans in to take up those farms that were now laying you know, idle. So that those stories are all a part of that Homefront story that I think is so important to tell.
I saw you once describe yourself as a truth teller of the heart, and you have all these stories, but what do you mean by that, truth teller of the heart?
I don't even remember saying that.
Well, you're a truth teller at heart, that's for sure.
Yes, that's true.
And what I was also struck by in just reading about you was you're wearing a uniform now, your park ranger uniform with a badge and everything else. And you walk often in pedestrian role with your uniform on because you feel it's important for young black girls.
Well, I didn't discover the National Park Service until fairly recently. And when I say recently, I say 20 years. I think I had taken my own children to Yosemite when they were little. But other than that, the National Park Service meant very little to me. What I discovered was the reach of the National Park Service. You can come into, at any point, into being a publicist, being a biologist, being a botanist, being a graphic artist, being all kinds of things, that the opportunities for employment are so great within the National Park System, and that the need to be sure that people of color understood the opportunities that could be offered through this agency means that I could be in uniform on the streets or in the elevator or on an escalator, and every little child of color might be able to be made aware of a possible career choice that without seeing me in that uniform, they might not know. And I think that, being in uniform is extremely important for those of us who are people of color, who are also able to wear those uniforms. Whether it's Forestry Service, whether it's the National Park Service, we need to announce those career choices to our children.
Well, you talk about the Park Service as having the potential for opportunities, but a lot of money has been cut back and it went through a bit of a scandal here in California, at least the parks did. And there's been a hue and cry about the fact that they're not necessarily expanding or getting the maintenance monies that they need.
That is a question that has to go much higher than I am. I'm not up that high and up on the food chain to be able to answer those things. I'm an interpretive park ranger.
Yeah, but you are a model, as you've said, and I mean, as you've kind of implicitly said, and remain a model for young people. I think that's great. You're also an elder now. I mean,
yes.
You know, a spokesperson and so forth. And let's talk about the park itself. What are the most important sites for you there?
Probably the memorial. The Rosie Memorial was designed by two San Francisco artists, Cheryl Barton and Susan Schwarzenberg, and it is an abstraction of a ship as it was built, but the entire home front story is carved into plaques. They're inlaid into the walkway. It's the length of a victory ship, and it's the place of my entry into the park system because I had never identified with Rosie the Riveter's story, because that's a white woman's story, but I did identify with the home front, and I found the first time I walked that memorial, I found my history there among all the others, and that, I think, remains up until the opening of the visitor center, which is work of art. But other than that, it's the memorial, I think, that carries the soul of this park.
The reason I spoke of you as optimistic before, you seemed a little resistant to that. But I read you talking about the arc of history, as Martin Luther King put it, turning toward fairness and justice and hoping that that's where destiny will take us. It seems that changes and your awareness of changes
suggests that. I don't think that's questionable.
You believe it?
Yes.
Fully.
Completely. Well, if you realize that that it may be the contrast, because there's a fearsome story that I live with too, and that's that my great grandmother in 1846 was born into a world that had a world population less than 2 billion, and at 93, I've lived into a world with a world population of 7.5 billion. That is staggering for me. That all of that happened in the lifetime of four generations of my own family, that is the fearsome part of it. My fear that we won't wake up, that we'll remain in denial too long to be able to make the corrections, the environmental questions, that's true. The other thing that's true is that the arc of my life, that I would have been a clerk in a Jim Crow segregated union hall in 1942, with only two opportunities for employment open to me, and that I would have returned 15 years ago to the city of Richmond, working in a one-person satellite office for a member of the California State Assembly. That was Dionne Arriner and her successor, Lonnie Hancock, after Dionne term limited out. But I'm working, helping to determine what kind of legislation might be needed out of the five cities of West Contra Costa County that we acted on, that I would have worked on constituency questions. That indicates how much social change had occurred in this nation over those intervening years. That has to be the source of a great deal of hope. Because if we could have gone that way in my lifetime, since I was 20, And that's not something that I did. That's not a question of personal achievement. That's something that we all did, all of us, black and white and brown, straight and gay. This is what we all accomplished. And some of us did a kicking and screaming, and some of us peeled off on issues along the way. But all of us, especially out of the Bay Area, have participated in accelerating the rate of social change so that to this day, my perception is that it still radiates out of the Bay Area into the rest of the country. And that largely comes out of what happened right here in the building of those ships.
Let's talk about what for you are the real important and most important lessons to come out of the home front experience.
Oh, I wish I were wise enough to be able to know that. I'm not sure I can answer that.
Well, you've intimated at it at different times that you thought, even now you're talking about social changes and they may have been tied to the country coming together in the war effort.
I think maybe I can answer that if I do it personally.
Go ahead.
Two of the questions that I've been able to answer for myself is that somewhere in the last decade, I know that I outlived my rage without losing my passion. And that has served me well, because when I needed my rage, it was there. And it served me well, and I've carried many a picket sign and been arrested at least twice for my principles, and that worked for me. And in the last 15 years, at least in the last decade, that ceased to be a need. The second thing happened when I began to accept the fact that it's possible to live with conflicting truths, that I couldn't have done that before in life. When I was 75, I don't think I'd have known that. But there's a question, there's a statement that Agnes Moore, who is still living, who's a Rosie out in Rossmore, who makes a statement on our orientation film, that it was the greatest coming together, that home front effort, was the greatest coming together of the American people that she had ever lived through. And I used to stand in the dark in the theater and listen to her utter those words, and I'd cringe, and I'd think, doesn't she know better than that? I mean, that was not true. And somewhere along the line, I aged into a place where I began to hear that as Agnes's truth. And that as long as there was a place on the planet where her truth and mine could coexist, that that was enough for me.
Right.
And I began to understand that that was possible.
Two essential truths and very important ones. Thank you for bringing those to our attention. And I want to bring you, our listeners, to the attention of the fact that you can join this conversation, and we welcome your phone calls and your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is available if you'd like to talk to Betty Reed Soskin, or if you have some thoughts that you'd like to add to the conversation, questions or comments about really the whole World War II home front and the historical period, we welcome your involvement. Some memories probably for many listeners too. Toll-free number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Betty Reed Soskin. This is part of our first-person series. She is a park ranger, the oldest park ranger in the nation, and she's with the National Park Service with the Rosie the Riveter's World War II home front national, that is National Historical Park, which is located in Richmond, talking about a whole range of things, talking about World War II and the home front, about Rosie the Riveter and Jim Crow, which actually made it unlikely, if not impossible, for African-American women to share that Rosie the Riveter experience, and also talking about the role that women of color had to put up with and had to accept to a great degree during the Second World War. But also historical national parks and Richmond itself, which, to quote Betty Reed Soskin, had, well, perhaps the greatest mobilization of human power since the pyramids. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. Certainly would like to hear from some of you who have memories, or certainly historical memories, your family, your mothers, your grandmothers, and so forth, and their role during the Second World War, aunts, great aunts, whatever. There's certainly a lot of memories to distill there, and we do want to hear what you have to say and your own stories. To join us, you can do that now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments or your own experiences onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum. And click on this segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. A couple of emails here. Amanda writes, my grandmother was a WAVE, Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service. I really know nothing about them or the work they did. Can you enlighten me? Is it correct to consider her a Rosie? And thanks for spreading the story of the home front, one I think the Bay Area too often forgets. The WAVES.
I think that there's a difference between those, the people who served in the armed forces. That would be WACs and WAVES and Marine Corps and Navy people and air pilots, and the home front, which is quite specifically those people who supported, who were in support of the armed forces. So I'm not sure that a WAVE would be considered a Rosie. I think that that's probably true.
And here's Tim, who says, although I know you're concentrating on the contribution of African-American women in the Richmond shipyards in this show, I'll share my mother, a Norwegian farm girl from Oregon, found work in the Bay Area as a welder in those same shipyards, another part of the major migration during World War II that built California as it would become.
Of course. There were people from all over the country. There were principally black and white Southerners out of the five Southern states, but there were, and that was for the four Kaiser shipyards. But there were 14 shipbuilding enterprises that circled the bay. So there were many, many people who came here as welders and riveters and as shipbuilders beside those who were involved with Kaiser.
And Victoria wants to know, does Ranger Suskin see gentrification in Richmond affecting whose history is being remembered? And what suggestions does she have to keep our histories alive for our youth?
Oh, that's a big question, and I think it's for a different program. I really do.
Well, you can go. They can get a tour from you, first
yes.
of all. That would be high on my list. Let me bring some callers in here, and let's go first to you, April. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm sitting in my car outside of my office listening to this, and I'm just finding I'm so happy to learn about you, and I'm just finding your story so extraordinary and inspiring, and I think you as an elder, but yet as sort of so contemporary and evolving in your views. And I don't know, I just find you very inspiring on many levels.
Thank you very much.
I'm really sorry. I would love to be like you, I guess. But my question is, I would love to book a tour with you. Do you book tours?
Yes, you can come to the visitor center.
I just saw a horrible accident on the freeway, and then I was listening to your discussion, and I just feel like, I don't know, life is important, and you've really made the most of it, and you're really inspiring.
Thank you so very much. But you can call Rosie the Riveter. World War II, Home Front, National Historical Park, or look us up online, and you can book tours. And I'm in the Visitor Center Tuesdays and Saturday afternoons at 2:00 with a presentation and a film, and on Thursday mornings at 11:00. And
April,
thank you, please.
Thank you for your call. I hope you get the car straightened out there. I appreciate hearing from you, and your sentiments are appreciated as well. We're going to get to more calls here. You once described yourself as an extraordinary, ordinary woman. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I think that the whole front was made up of extraordinary, ordinary people. I think that Heinrich Kaiser was also an extraordinary, ordinary person. He was an eighth grade dropout, dropped out of school at 13, came here as a cement contractor, never having built a ship, and nonetheless completed 747 ships in 3 years and 8 months.
And we'll go to more of our callers. This is a caller from Menlo Park. Allison, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I went to Mills College, which was the first place a woman could go to school west of the Mississippi for a very long time. And I was wondering, did anyone from Mills have anything to do with the Rosie the Riveter building extravaganza?
From Mills College?
Yes.
I have no idea. I grew up almost within walking distance of Mills College. But it was that mysterious place behind the Ivy League, Ivy Walls, that I didn't ever get into until I was an adult.
And I don't think African-American women got in there for the years we're talking about.
I think that Mills College has a pretty good record.
Oh, they do now.
Yeah. But that wasn't being heard of. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the call, Allison. Good to hear from you. And we'll go right to another caller from Oakland. It's Mahasin.
Yes.
Hi.
Thank you, Michael. How are you today?
Thank you. Okay.
And such a wonderful program. I had two relatives, my mother and cousin, who were African-American contributors to the war effort, the defense effort in shipbuilding. And I'll never forget the stories. We used to sit at her knee and listen to her describe the physical work that women did. And it made me, I think that was the beginning of my consciousness of women's equality, quote unquote, in that sense with men, because the defense effort was literally colorblind when it came to muscle and defending the home front. And so many stories I still cherish about how my family, especially the women, contributed here at home, while my father, who was a former Tuskegee Airman, participated overseas.
Yeah, I would share that pride that you're expressing. But there's also, for me, the reality of having been there in that I know the sequence in which people were hired. First, it was men who were too old to fight. And then it was second hired were the boys who were too young to be drafted. And then it was single white women. And then married white women. And then not until 1943, black men began to be hired as helpers and trainees to do the heavy lifting for the women they'd brought on board. And it wasn't until late in 1944 when black women, who in some cases had been hired as laborers, began to be trained as welders. And so that sequence suggests that was an evolutionary process in social change, and that over those 3.5 years, an awful lot of progress was made socially, and that wasn't in the beginnings, and that we did participate as full workers toward the end of the war. But it took time.
Let me thank Mahasin for the call and go to more emails. Here's Carol, who writes, "What a revelation. As I am listening to you, I am scanning the web for information about you. I see photographs of you in all your beauty with a guitar. Are you a singer? And have you written a book telling your life story? If not, please do. What an inspiration you would provide to so many girls and women of all colors."
There was a time when I was singing, but never professionally.
What kind of music did you do?
Betty music. I was doing a lot of composing. And it was a time when I had actually suffered a mental break when my children were young, when I was living in hostel suburbs and not knowing quite how to deal with what was going on around me. And I took refuge in the artist part of me, and that came alive. And during those about 10 years, and that was how I knew Carol Pearson, began to sing and to write music. And I didn't need that Betty when I came back into Richmond, back into Berkeley from the suburbs. And that Betty has been tucked away.
Can you talk a little bit, it may be uncomfortable, and I'm sorry if it is, about that hostility when you and your husband wanted to build a home in Walnut Creek?
Yeah.
How did it manifest? I know you were your lives were threatened. But
both Mel and I had grown up in the Bay Area. He was a third-generation Californian. His family had come out during the Civil War. And I was here since I was 6 years old. We met when I was 14. And we're married by the time I guess I was 20. And because he was actually a professional football player at the time, he graduated from the University of San Francisco playing left halfback for the San Francisco Dons when we were married. And because his friends were buying in the suburbs, because the people that I'd grown up with were moving to the suburbs in 1950, 53. We decided that we were going to also build our house in the suburbs, and didn't realize that those people were out there to get away from people like us. And so our lives were threatened. The first year that my third grader entered school, the fundraiser that year by the PTA was a minstrel show, and his teachers and his principal were all in blackface. This was a cruel time, and this is who we were in 1953.
Anybody in that neighborhood welcome you or act warmly
Absolutely.
Toward you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Just as we became the targets of bigotry, we also became the object of the liberals who then made us their heroes. And so there were balancing factors, and that's probably what saved our lives.
Here's a listener named Banu who says, please ask Ms. Hoskin to share the story she told us one day about the young African-American men who used to come to her home to have lemonade, and then she did not see them after the big explosion in the port of Richmond.
Oh, the USO, which was, of course, the United Service Organization, which was created to entertain the troops when they were on shore, was not integrated. And so we entertained young black service people in our homes. And that afternoon, on July 17th of 1944, my husband, who at that time was a playground director in the daytime at San Pablo Park in Berkeley, and would gather up kids in uniform and bring them to our house on Sacramento Street, our duplex, to have lemonade parties. That day, there were about a dozen young dock workers, sailors from Port Chicago that he brought home. We spent the afternoon with them. They got back into their jeeps to get back to their base. And that evening at 10:47, those two Kaiser ships exploded, and 320 men were lost, and 202 of them were black service people. We never knew whether or not any of our guests had survived, because there were 22 caskets that were buried in the colored section of San Bruno Cemetery containing the body parts of those people who were buried as unknowns. So Port Chicago has always had a great deal of meaning for me.
Well, actually, we have a caller who wants, in fact, we did a show many years ago. I don't know if it's even in our, remains in our archives about Port Chicago. But here's Bob from Hercules who has something to say about Port Chicago. Bob, welcome.
Yes.
Thank you for the show. I'm going to start at modern times and kind of work backwards. There were sunset laws around the Bay Area, even in the 70s, where blacks couldn't be in certain towns, one of them being Napa. And there was a black teacher who eventually moved up into administration in that school district. Another thing was Willie Mays, the San Francisco Giant, was kind of blocked out of moving to a white area, and that's in the 60s. I was a boilermaker there in Richmond, and Ernie King, the president, black man, really did a lot to train people. He used to go to San Quentin, where they had a welding school. That was when they rehabbed inmates instead of just warehoused them. And the Port Chicago catastrophe of the blacks quit working. They said they were, you know, they mutinied or whatever. And later on, I think in the 90s, they were all given medals or some sort of recognition for their efforts. And the war effort in general, the war of the world. I mean, we had Nazis in Imperial Japan, and from Seattle to San Diego, there were airplane and shipyards. And the previous caller, really proud of the black airmen who were trained and went to Europe. It seems like as America got desperate, and she mentioned the criteria kept changing for skilled people, as America got desperate or woke up to it, they used all the resources. I've been to the museum. I was born in Richmond, and I sure appreciate the show.
Well, we appreciate hearing from you, Bob, and we thank you for the call. And Let me bring another caller on here. This is Pat from Los Altos. Pat, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to pay tribute to my Aunt Frances, who was born in 1916, went out to work as a nanny for $2 a week, and when the war started, she went to work for GE building aircraft engines. It was a huge adventure for her. They discovered that she was capable of reading blueprints. And when the war tapered down and they didn't need the aircraft engines, they asked her to come to GE in Bridgeport, Connecticut to help them work on the first TVs. And when I was a little kid, I remember she brought us one of the first models, which had a round TV screen. But she was always my inspiration because she didn't marry until she was 42. So she was an early career woman. And I always respected her so much, and I loved her stories. So I really appreciate your show. It brings back so many memories of my wonderful Aunt Frances. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call, Pat. Good to hear from you. Appreciate your call. Listener on Facebook named Martha writes, Ms. Soskin has so much wisdom and so many important stories. Has she considered writing a book? We already covered that, Tori. But you have a link up to your blog, and it's on our website. We have
yes.
it on there. It's go to kqed.org/forum. And
that's my book.
That's your book, basically. Yeah, understood. Let me get another caller on. It's Nancy from Santa Rosa. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I just wanted to say I have been on a tour with Betty at the Rosie the Riveter Museum, and my husband and I thought it was one of the most special experiences that we have ever had. I learned so much about history that I didn't know about, not just about the shipyards and the riveters, but about the incredible sociological change that went on in this country at that time. And Betty just made everything come alive, and I would highly, highly recommend this to anybody. I've recommended it to so many friends. It is worth getting a reservation and going over there and going on the tour with Betty. So thank you, Betty, so much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for that call. We'll go to another call in a moment, but I'm looking at a listener named Mark who writes, Hi, Betty. I have been fortunate enough to talk to you on a couple of occasions and yet still didn't realize what a wise woman you are. Though you are widely known locally and held in high esteem, I wish the entire country could know you and hear your words. Love to you. That's from Mark.
Thank you.
Here's somebody named Dan who says, I'm an amateur historian and a while ago read the final report on a program that provided child care to Rosies in San Francisco during the war. The report authors interviewed 1,500 mothers who were Rosies, and most of them had no desire to be working in the shipyards and coped with awful anxiety because of the city's lack of formal child care for working mothers. Many had to place their children in foster care because they had to work to survive. Their children were sometimes adopted before the women could return to their normal lives. The Rosie the Riveter story has a romantic patina, but it had a dark side for mothers.
There's another side of that story, though, and that's that you're talking about San Francisco, that in Richmond, Kaiser brought in Dr. Catherine Landreth from the University of California, who had a theory that little children were capable of learning and that caretaking wasn't enough. And what was created there in the Maritime Child Development Centers, which are part of the park, was a system that became the progenitor for Head Start. And we're still living with that. So that was another of those things. So the story that is being told by this listener was certainly not universal. It probably was more common around the rest of the country. But in Richmond, in the park that we represent.
You realize you're a natural-born storyteller.
Absolutely.
And historian. Yeah. I mean, that serves you well in your work as a tour guide, obviously, because you do it so well. Here's Steve from Berkeley who writes, My aged mother-in-law as a teenager during World War II worked assembling bomb sites. Perhaps during her next visit, we should take her to the memorial. She worked in a suburb of Tokyo where there was also great sacrifice and deprivation on the home front. The more things seem different, the more they are the same. Another listener, Tom, says, Thanks for today's program. It's a story that conjures up a lot of memories from my mother, a woman who served in the U.S. Coast Guard as an anti-sabotage investigator in an aircraft factory on the East Coast. While the idea of German agents in Connecticut now seems both far away and equally unlikely, I have nothing but admiration for all the women who serve their country in ways that simply don't get enough praise from all of us. And a listener tweets, I'd love to ask Betty about becoming a ranger. I'm currently a teacher who loves history, and a job like hers sounds idyllic.
I sort of backed into becoming a ranger. It's that I'm doing what I've always been doing wherever I've been working, and now they call it rangering, and that works fine for me.
And now they call you Ranger Betty.
Yes, now they call me Ranger Betty.
And we'll bring another caller on, and that's Bill from San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Bill, are you there?
Are you sure you're not asking for Dale?
Oh, maybe I am. Are you going to talk about your mother as a Rosie?
Yes.
Okay, then it's Dale. Go ahead.
Okay. Quickly, my mother was a true Rosie the Riveter. She started out being a true riveter on aircraft fuselages, on bombers. And she had the unfortunate job of being the person on the inside of the fuselage who held the block while the riveter on the outside pounded away with a pneumatic tool. But then she later switched to working on the glass tubes, making the what they call bottles for the radio tubes on a lathe, and that's where she met my father, and that was in 1944. So I'm a war baby, and so I have a very deep and dear connection to the Rosie the Riveter. History. So
yes, you bring up a good point, because innovation that Henry Kaiser introduced into shipbuilding was that he replaced riveting with welding, and that the riveters were largely those women who were working with aircraft shipbuilding, because replacement of the riveting made the ships faster and lighter, so that. Most of the Rosies were riveters involved with the aircraft.
And we thank you for that, Bill. Appreciate hearing your memories, your story. Charlie wants to know, what's the story of Point Richmond in this story?
I have no idea.
Okay. Somebody out there may know, one of our oral historians. But Joe tweets, can you speak to what happened to the women shipyard workers after the war?
Oh, we all went home and made babies for the most part. We went back to baking cookies, and we were fed a decade of Donna Reed and June Cleaver in high heels and aprons, and were retrained for going back to our real roles. I don't think some of us went back happily, but pretty much that was what happened. We were expected to go home so that the returning veterans could get those high-paying jobs.
Well, since you're talking about Donna Reed and those kind of stories that were so popular throughout the United States in that early era of television, mm-hmm. again, about the closest you could come to seeing African-American women was in Beulah, the story of a maid.
Absolutely.
That was a very popular show for a while.
Absolutely.
Yeah, or Amos and Andy.
And white people in blackface.
Well, and your family, I mean, especially you knew this even as you grew up and as you got your own family history, they had to go through back doors. They had to serve for the most part.
Of course. My family left New Orleans, which was our ancestral home. And when I say ancestral, I mean the Charbonnet family goes back to the 1700s in New Orleans. It was when... In, I guess, 1918, my father called a white man by his first name, and the family had to get him out of New Orleans with his family into Detroit, Michigan, where he went to work for Ford in order to save his life. And that's how I came to be born in Detroit.
So all you had to do was call a white man by—I mean, this is something that Richard Wright called, the famous African-American novelist,
yeah.
The ethic of living Jim Crow.
Absolutely.
You had to always defer to white people. You couldn't even broach certain subjects.
You had to step off into the gutter if a white person approached.
Yeah. I mean, it's,
and as I keep saying, that's who we were in those years. And anyone who says the change, we've not experienced change as a nation, has not lived my life.
Well, even Martin Luther King thought there'd never be an African-American president. How could that be? And tell us about your experience at the inauguration. Aside from having your grandmother's picture with you, what was it like?
That was unbelievable, because it was an experience of being with, 2 million of my very new best friends. It was my second trip to Washington, D.C., and the first trip I had experienced with my husband, who was on a visit to NIDA, which he was working on a contract with the University of California. And at that time, seeing African Americans in the museums and in the Smithsonian institutions was pretty rare. But to be in Washington for the inauguration and watching people of color entering all of those museums with a sense of ownership was just astounding. I don't think I've been that high before or since.
Well, on that note, it's been a real pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for all the wisdom you've imparted and the stories you've told in this hour. Appreciate so much having you on. America's oldest park ranger, bringing history to life at Richmond's Rosie the Riveter Park, Betty Reed Soskin. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and we certainly appreciate your listenership. We also play another hour in the evening from 10 to 11, but you can always listen to us online as well. I like to remind people. And you can also let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.